values and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show, KTAR News, 92.3 FM, and the KTAR News app.
All right, happy Friday. Thanks for being here. Appreciate it as always. With headline, Arizona public school districts are picking up the tab for ESA special needs evaluations. What that means is, and I'm give you the subheadline, since the universal voucher program was passed nearly 2 years ago, there has been a surge of families going to school districts seeking special needs evaluations. I need to back up. If you're not familiar with ESAs, ESAs were called Empowerment Scholarship Accounts. They were originally set up for special needs families, families of students with special needs. The idea behind the voucher program was this: thousands of dollars set aside in education spending, the tax dollars used for each child's education federally and you know, state dollars, and that special needs parents were equipped to know better what the unique needs and educational challenges their child had and what best suited their educational needs. Makes perfect sense. You have a child that's got special needs, you understand it's unique, and you understand that what it is that best suits them and their educational needs to give them the best opportunity at educational success. That's what an ESA is. It was expanded a couple of years ago because the thought process, and I don't know how you argue with this, is that every child has a unique educational need. Not every kid is a cookie cutter, fit in the same square peg in a square hole kind of puzzle. That kids can be unique, even in your own family. If you've got children and you've got multiple children, they're different. One excels at math, the other excels at science. School is easy for one, it's a challenge for the other. One gets bored very easily. One is very visual. All of these different things that play into what is the best way, because you parent differently. I don't know of a parent that parents a child, every one of their children, the same way, ever. And so that uniqueness to that education, it makes sense that the expansion of the ESA program was that every parent, given an opportunity, if they say my child is not flourishing or is not excelling as much as he or she could in a district school, I want to use the ESAs to send my child to a charter school, or I'm going to send my child to a private school, or a home, we're going to homeschool, or a micro school, or whatever it is. If it's something unique to your child and it helps them in education, you should be able to do that. But the Empowerment Scholarship Accounts originally were for special needs students. And here was the thought. Now, there was a very, of all of the money allocated, only a small percentage was being used by special needs students. They were not coming anywhere near what the budget was allocated for that money. So the fear was, the first fear from the anti-ESA crowd, expansion crowd, was, well, now you're going to have kids without special needs, going to take all this money away from the special needs kids, and there won't be enough for special needs kids, which was a false narrative. It wasn't true. Now there's too many parents that are looking for this. This to me is such a, it's such an odd thing. I don't understand this. I'm pretty pragmatic in understanding people that differ from me in disagreements, but how can anybody out there say that a parent who pays taxes shouldn't have the ability to use that tax dollar any way they see fit for their child? I don't care if you're a wealthy parent that can afford a private school without the education dollars you already pay for, or if you're a working class family that could never afford a private education, but these scholarships give you an opportunity to do that. Or you're a parent that's got a child that's challenged, educationally challenged, she's got some special needs, and you have got to have specialized training and education for them, that you have the dollars available to make sure your child gets the best education possible. How do you argue? Well, you argue because what it does is the district schools are finding a drop in enrollment. Scottsdale Unified is finding younger and younger kids that they're not getting the enrollment. They're not getting butts in seats. Butts in seats equate to dollars because schools and districts get their budget based on enrollment, and they don't like seeing kids not enrolled in their district. So we've been hearing for years about overcrowded classrooms, and the classrooms have too many kids in them. Teachers are overwhelmed trying to educate students. Now the class sizes are shrinking, but so are the dollars. Now it's a bad thing that the schools are shrinking. First they were too full, now they're not full enough. I think what's happening, and I firmly believe this, what is happening is that education is changing. You look at a school, and I do this all the time with Arizona State University. You look at what ASU has done under Michael Crow, under Dr. Crow. You look at how they have changed, and you look at how they are changing K through 12 education with their K through 12 education program at ASU. If there's one person that understands that education changes, it's changing there. You look at the model that they've used at Grand Canyon University. We just talked with Brian Mueller yesterday. They teach from a Christian worldview at GCU. It's growing to possibly become one of the biggest universities in the entire country, if not the biggest in the entire nation. The changes in how kids change, and GCU is enrolling kids in online programs and doing it better than anyone a long time before. They have an on-campus presence and a huge online presence. If you are not changing, you're dying. And when you get leaders that understand that, and for all of the people in Arizona that call themselves progressive, the progressives in Arizona are the ones fighting progress in education. You got teacher organizations that are fighting this tooth and nail because they don't like the fact that the districts aren't controlling the dollars anymore. But you look at the changes they've been forced to make. The Phoenix Union High School District is doing television ads. And they're saying to families, hey, listen, pick a school. Look at everything we have to offer you and your kids. We are going to cater to your children's educational needs. Schools are beginning to brag about their reading and math scores going up and their dedication to the core curriculum. And they're going to teach your children to read. They're making the changes necessary to get butts in seats, realizing now they have to compete with other places. There are going to be bad schools. There are going to be schools that start up, that underperform, that are going to take money from people and not do what they say they're going to do. It's a part of it. There are going to be parents that commit acts of fraud with the ESA program. It's going to happen, just like it does in the welfare programs. It doesn't mean school choice is bad. Here's some headlines. Furry claims spark walkout at a Utah middle school. A petition against furries at school garnered 1,700 signatures. What that means, a furry is, these are kids that are identifying as animals. And they're coming to school dressed like animals, and they're biting and they're kicking their classmates like an animal would. I'm not making this up. This is what's happening. And the school districts are allowing kids to identify as furries. And there are some parents that are going to say, you're not going to do that here. I'm not putting my child through that. My child's going to go to a classroom or go to a setting where there's going to be education, where they're going to sit at a desk and they're not going to be bitten by a kid next to them dressed like a horse. Does that sound unreasonable? It doesn't to me. Is this an extreme example? It's absolutely an extreme example, but it doesn't mean it's not happening. A Michigan school district in an elementary school are teaching children about pronouns, tree and they. And they say that it's an important part of gender politics and gender learning. And there are many parents that are saying it's too young for my kid. My kid doesn't need to talk about this. My children should be learning to read in elementary school. Teach them to read. We'll worry about sexuality at another time. It doesn't make parents bigots. It certainly doesn't make them transphobic or racist or any of those other things. But parents that want to make choices for their children to be in that setting will have schools for that setting. But parents that don't should be able to choose a school that doesn't. That's what school choice is all about. And I think that's why it's here to stay. In a moment, Governor Hobbs sets a new Arizona veto record. And she does it in record time. We're going to tell you the importance of that coming up in just a moment.
Strong values and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show. KTAR News, 92.3 FM and the KTAR News app.
All right, let's talk about the legislature and what our friends down at the Arizona State Legislature, we got a lot to talk about today legislatively. They definitely put the fun in dysfunction at the Capitol, that's for sure. And we know that the governor, when she came into office last year, set a record in 1 year for vetoes. And she sent a message. And I don't agree with her vetoes, but I certainly agree with the ability and the right for the governor to do that and set a tone. What she's going to do and what she's not. not going to do. There's a lot of power in that office. And one of the powers of that office with executive powers is the power of the veto. Do I think that there is a different way of handling? Would I handle it that way? I wouldn't, but I'm certainly not. I certainly understand what she did and why she did it, if that makes sense. You can have a severe disagreement with someone and understand she was sending a message. There's a new sheriff in town. And so she sent that message. But in 15 months, she has set a record for vetoes that beat a record in the entire 1.5 terms of Janet Napolitano. 185 vetoes in 15 months. Now, in comparison, Governor Napolitano had 6 years worth of vetoes, and she vetoed 181. So, and I'll tell you this, the legislature that Janet Napolitano, Governor Napolitano, dealt with was a much more conservative Republican majority. There were a lot more Republicans then than there are now. So this isn't a criticism. I'm making an observation first. I believe it's been 167 bills this session she has signed into law. She's vetoed 42 bills so far this year. She replaced vetoed bills that would replace the word gender in all state statutes with sex defined as a person's biological sex at birth. It's just so the bubble that we live in with this stuff, calling it unnecessary and all these other things. When we keep hearing the Ten Commandments, allowing them in the classroom, things like this. But when you look at some of the other things that have been vetoed, let's talk about one that's serious. There has been bipartisan work done on a housing bill. And when you look at the housing bill, it was an affordable housing bill. There is a California Democratic congressman weighing in on what Arizona did. Now, I don't know why California is doing this, but it is important to say that this is a Democrat. Congressman Robert Garcia told the Arizona Mirror, he said, to me, the DOD kind of effort goes against what the Biden administration plans for the country. The Department of Defense lobbied the Arizona governor, citing concerns that having this affordable housing would cause people to build more houses near a military installation, and it might cause more accidents. Now, I don't know how the two correlate. They do, I guess. But I guess it would be, well, Luke Air Force Base. I know Luke Air Force Base, when I first moved here almost 30 years ago, Luke Air Force Base was considered to genuinely be out in the middle of nowhere. And people used to go, if you know where it's at, it's Litchfield Road. You go north on Litchfield Road, you get to about Northern. It's in those cross street areas. And people would go on the north side of the airport on Northern of the Air Force Base. And you could actually sit on the other side of the road and watch the planes land and take off. One day a week when they were doing some of the flight training, because at the time it was F-16s. That every F-16 pilot in the world at one time, and I mean in the world, when the U.S. would sell F-16s to other nations, allied nations, their pilots would train here in Arizona, at least for a time. Now it's the F-35s, and there are other training bases, but the Luke Air Force Base is one of them. And you can, if you're out in the West Valley, you can see them taking off, and when they're training new pilots and they do the side-by-sides and the touch-and-goes. And, it, you know, for people that are into that kind of thing, it's an amazing thing to see. And now it's not, you can't do that stuff anymore. And they've rerouted the roads around there so that the freeway goes much further north from the airfield. But there's so much out there. If you go out at the 303 in Northern, the 303 was just a thought back then. The Wildlife World Zoo, an aquarium, is out there. It's an amazing place. It's been out there for a very long time. But right across the street, on the other side, on the north side of the street, and it's just on the east side of the 101, Desert Diamond is building a huge casino resort out there. You drive all over the West Valley there on the 303, there's huge growth. So we're seeing immense growth near the Air Force Base anyway. I don't understand why the Department of Defense would be upset about housing developments being built out there. And what is the insinuation that affordable housing? I want you to think about that. Imagine if you are somebody that's in the United States military. They don't make a whole lot of money. But affordable housing for someone that has reached a level in their enlistment where they're making enough money to buy a home, why wouldn't you want to build a smaller, affordable home for someone in the military to buy? They serve their 4 years, they serve 6 or 8 years, they serve 10 or 12 years, and they decide they're going to retire. Now that home has gained equity. They're not paying rent anymore. They do get a housing allowance, so it helps them pay for it. But in the end, they've got a ton of equity when they sell and they retire somewhere else or they move into another industry. I don't understand these vetoes. I understand some. I don't agree with them, but I understand them. If, from her political perspective, I understand why she did them. I don't understand the Molly bill and the veto last time around, and I don't understand the affordable housing bill and not allowing growth and managed growth to help people afford homes. I just disagree with it. In a moment, we have got to talk about the border. The Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas goes before Congress the day after the impeachment hearings ended. No trial. We'll talk about what happened, and you're going to hear how he did not answer a question that is very interesting. We'll get to that coming up in just a moment.
Strong values and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show. KTAR News, 92.3 FM, and the KTAR News app.
Thanks for being here. Do either one of you, Julia, let me ask you a question. Speaking of this Cool J, don't call it a comeback. That's how the song goes. Let's talk about Mike Tyson for a minute. Do you think Mike Tyson and Jake Paul is a real deal, this fight?
I gotta be so honest. I do not care about
really?
That fight one bit.
I have to tell you, first of all, I am an insanely big Mike Tyson fan.
Why?
I love Mike Tyson. I've loved him since he was a professional fighter. I love his raw story. I think he's been so brutally honest about his whole life. He was even brutally honest about losing a child. I love the story of Mike Tyson. I just love the guy. I've been a fan forever. And I just really, really, really hope this is real and he knocks Jake Paul out of his shoes. I know that's terrible to say, but I want this to be real and I want him to knock that kid out so bad.
That's so funny. I think for me, I don't really like watching all of the, I don't know what to call it, like a lack for a better word, the fighting sports. I don't like watching boxing. I don't like watching the UFC, WWE. None of that is for me.
Oh, I
truly.
Love it.
I haven't paid attention. I mean, I kind of know what you're talking about when you mention that fight. I've seen some of the Twitter or X stuff, but yeah. I really don't care.
Mike Tyson was so feared. He was a young man. He was so young when he won the national championship or won the world championship the first time. And he was fighting a guy that was not only a world champion, but had already had, you know, 30 or 40 professional fights. And he was terrified of Mike Tyson. And Tyson just destroyed him and just was, oh, it was just, I love Mike Tyson.
So why would there be a reason for it to not be real?
Because he's 60 years old. And he's fighting a guy that is a influencer and kind of a YouTube star. And so is it something that's kind of a setup for money? That kind of, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that makes
sense. It's an exhibition fight. It's not sanctioned or anything, but I want it to be a real fight. I want this to be the real deal.
Huh. All right. Keep an eye on it.
Sorry about that. I just wanted to go when the song came on, because Tyson would come out to that song. At least he did in one fight that I saw, a couple of them. So it should be fun to watch this happen. The Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas was in front of Congress. He was at a Senate hearing right after the Senate decided not to go to a trial and kind of break with tradition against Mayorkas. But he did get asked questions because one of the charges against him was he didn't do his job. And the other was he lied under oath. He intentionally lied under oath by saying to the United States Congress that the border was secure when he knew that it wasn't. So in this line of questioning, Senator Mitt Romney asks him about that.
The House, I believe, House of Representatives, took action to underscore the extent of this crisis. And the Democrats decided they didn't want to spend more time talking about that. But I'm going to ask you a couple questions. They're not intended to be hostile, but the House said that you lied when you said to the House in a hearing that the border was secure. Why did you say the border was secure? Was that a lie? What do you mean by that?
Okay, so there's the question. Did you lie about that? is the border secured? This is how he answered the first time.
Senator Romney, allow me to assure you that I have honored the oath of office that I have taken more than five times in my 22 plus years of federal service.
So it's a non-answer. Here's what happened next.
Let me go back to the question. That's as accurate as it is irrelevant, which is my question is, you said that the border was secure. What did you mean when you said the border was secure? Is that not a lie?
Senator, you've asked me now if that is a lie, and I have assured you that I have honored the oath of office that I have taken.
In what way was it not a lie then?
Senator, with the resources and authorities that we have, it is as secure as it can be.
I don't know why that makes me laugh so much, but this is the old phrase of twisting yourself into a pretzel. Mayorkas understands how important this is in this sense. You are testifying before the United States Senate. Impeachment proceedings were brought against you because you were called a liar because you said the border is secure. You don't want to go back and say I lied before because you're proving them right. But you know that you can't again say that it is, or you can't say that it isn't. You're caught between a rock and a hard place. So Romney asks again.
The law states, and the House correctly noted, that encounters at the border and people seeking parole and so forth should be detained, and yet you release them. Why did you release them?
That's the question. So, again, here it goes.
Senator, we release individuals into immigration enforcement proceedings when our detention capacity cannot meet them in detention and they do not pose a threat to public safety or national security based upon the screening and vetting that we perform at the border.
Clearly that screening and vetting was insufficient given the number of murders and other crimes committed by a number of those people.
And the number of people on the terror watch list. Yesterday on the show, we had a story about someone on the terror watch list that was released into this program with either a monitoring device and an ankle bracelet or a cell phone or some kind of monitoring device. This person was then released off of that program, even though they were an Afghan national that was on the terror watch list. So this was the line of questioning. And it is an absolutely fair question. And to further talk about what's happening, I want you to hear a couple of people and how they've spoken about this in the past and how they're speaking about it now. In May of 2018, the LA mayor, Karen Bass, is talking about being a sanctuary city in the city of Los Angeles.
We need to think about how we as the United States can help those countries in Central America. You know, many of the gangs that caused the violence in Central America, those gangs started right here in Los Angeles. When we deported the gang members, we exported the problem. So I think that we should help the country so that people don't have to make that journey.
But now that they've made the journey, yeah, what do we do?
It is legal for people to come to our border and ask for asylum. So what we need to do is process each individual application.
That was 2018. Same mayor, 2023.
I mean, we live in a city that welcomes immigrants. And so I think we have been able to handle it. But I am fearful that any day planes could start coming.
D.C. Mayor Bowser, 2019.
This month and every month, we celebrate every immigrant who is now a part of our D.C. community. We celebrate those seeking citizenships and those who are not. And those who are still trying to navigate and figure out what's best for them and their families.
All right, so now 3 years later, same mayor.
We're not a border town. We don't have an infrastructure to handle this type of a level of immigration to our city.
So now you've got Eric Adams, mayor of New York, August of 2022.
I have to provide services for families that are here, and that's what we're going to do. And that's what our responsibility as a city. I'm proud that this is a right to shelter state, and we're going to continue to do that.
That was August of 2022. 2 months later, same mayor.
Our right to shelter laws, our social services, and our values are being exploited by others for political gain. New Yorkers are angry. I am angry too. If these trends continue, we will be over 100,000 in the year to come. That's far more than the system was ever designed to handle. This is unsustainable.
That was just 2 months later. Now go forward 1 year, same mayor in September of 23.
Never in my life Have I had a problem that I did not see an ending to? I don't see an ending to this. I don't see an ending to this. This issue will destroy New York City.
There you have it. These are people that were proud of being sanctuary cities that are now saying these rules, these laws have got to change. In a moment, an Arizona legislator has dropped out of the race for re-election because of accusations that he forged signatures to get on the ballot. We're going to talk about the fallout from this and why it's such a big story next.
Strong values and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show. KTAR News, 92.3 FM and the KTAR News app.
All right, a few minutes left in this hour, about halfway through our work day, which means we're going to end our work week. Representative Austin Smith left the race for re-election because he's been accused of forgery on turning in signatures. Now, whether he forged the signatures or he swore and affirmed that the signatures were legitimate, either way, he would be on the hook in an investigation if he stayed in the race. So he released a 2-page statement saying that I'm stepping out of the race because if they find out that even one of these signatures is fraudulent, I could be held accountable and I couldn't run again for 5 years. So stepping out of the race means that the investigation stops because it now has, he's not in the race any longer, means a Republican write-in candidate will be there. Here's where the issue lies. Austin Smith is a legislator who was one of the most vocal stolen election proponents that are out there. And you know where I stood on this issue, I didn't believe that the election was stolen in 2020 nor 2022. He does, and was a very adamant, outspoken person. He was somebody that was connected very in the higher ups with Turning Point USA, which is another organization that I've got respect for. This is not about Turning Point, but he resigned his position at Turning Point USA in the wake of this decision to step out of this race. I believe the Secretary of State Fontes has requested that the Arizona Attorney General further this investigation, because if you swear and affirm these signatures are real and you know they are not, that is a crime. The Secretary of State wants the Attorney General to investigate. County Supervisor Clint Hickman has also called for him to step out of office and leave the state legislature. And so this is another story. Lori Roberts over at AZ Central writes, Rep. Austin Smith should resign now if he refuses to fight forgery claims. No matter what you think, this puts everybody in a very bad position. If you're, I am a registered Republican, obviously, and a very conservative Republican. I didn't like the way some of the people fought. If you were, and I was someone that fought the election denial. I didn't think the election was stolen. I still hold to that belief. But I was respectful. I've been respectful of people, everyone that was connected to the audit when it happened to the 2020 election. Senator Karen Fan, the previous senator here in Arizona, we still maintain a relationship. I always was friendly with her. I have many people that firmly believe that the election was stolen and they believe they have evidence. Even though I disagree with them, I maintain a friendship and a mutual respect with them. But there are people, there have been people that were not just adamant about the election denial, but they were furious with anyone that disagreed with them, especially if they were in the same party as them. And I think this is where the problem lies. And the problem lies in the vitriol that was brought forward. The horrible things that were said about Clint Hickman and Bill Gates and the county board of supervisors and others, the names they were called, the accusations flung their way of illegality and intentional illegal behavior, and all of those things were flung in their direction. Now you've got somebody that was flinging a lot of those accusations being accused of forgery and has stepped out of the race. That's not an admission of guilt, but has left the race and left his position with Turning Point USA. So why would you resign from an organization like Turning Point and not resign from the legislature? And I don't say that lightly. My party has a 1-seat majority in each of the House and in the Senate. So which means here that this would damage the Republicans' ability to get anything done in this session. So I don't know that the Republicans are going to push for this. There's going to be a write-in candidate in his district. But in the end, we are still suffering as a state. We are suffering the fallout from this battle within an election denial. And this just tears the scab off what was a healing wound. And this is where it wasn't the argument. It wasn't the debate. I will always have a debate with someone I disagree with. We should always talk about our differences openly. And I have an open policy with people, and they have it with me, to tell me. I don't mind when someone tells me they think I'm wrong, and I will tell them when I think they're wrong. I think that's a healthy relationship. The problem lies when it gets to be so vitriolic and nasty that you are leveling criminal accusations, calling someone treasonous because you say that they intentionally stole an election from their own party. Well, now you know why someone like a Clint Hickman is now saying, wait a minute, over 100 signatures here. You're just going to walk away. You're going to step out of the election, and no one's going to investigate any further of whether or not that this was an obvious fraud on the voters in your district. It opens the wounds, and it's a wound that I hope heals faster and sooner than later for everyone, not just Republicans, for everyone involved in this issue. Moving forward, what do we do? And I think it's a great question, and I think this is just another ugly chapter in this ugly fight we've had. Coming up in just a moment, we are going to talk about our ballot. And we're going to talk about the fight and the poll numbers and how they seem to be narrowing, and the Arizona Senate race. It's all coming up.